This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, February 5th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we'll check in with CAI's Mike Dean at the State House. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We're joined by CAI reporting staff. With us is Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steven.
Also, we have CAI environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff. Hi, Eve.
Morning, Steve.
And with us also, Morning Edition producer and reporter Sam Houghton. Hi, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Thank you all for being with us. Phase two of the state's vaccination rollout started this week. There have been plenty of bumps, but also some victories to celebrate. On Wednesday, Barnstable County held its first coronavirus vaccination clinic. Jeanette Barnes, you were there. Tell us what this was, where this was, and what it was like.
Sure. It was at the Cape Cod Fairgrounds, and the county had 600 doses to give out. They did it drive-through in a drive-through fashion. So cars were directed into three lanes that went up under the roof of a metal barn-type building that's there on the fairgrounds. Volunteers were approaching the vehicles to check for appointments, and then drivers would move forward in the line to a station where nurses were administering the vaccine. And that was a combination of public health nurses who were employed by the county and then some contract nurses, and they were doing that in all three lanes. Then after they, folks got the vaccine, the drivers were directed out into two exit lanes where they had to wait to watch for any reaction to the vaccine, which I understand is happening at all vaccine clinics. It's a 30-minute wait if you have a history of reactions, or 15 minutes if you don't. So people seemed upbeat and everything was orderly while I was there. By the time I was leaving at 1, the line was getting quite a bit longer. So it's possible that might have tested people's patience later in the day. It was very upbeat while I was there.
So as I said, this was the very first Barnstable County clinic, but they've got other ones lined up, or they have plans for other ones. Is that right?
Right. Well, they had a smaller one the next day at the Melody Tent, and they are planning to do them, I believe, every week somewhere on the Cape. So, but right now they're only getting 975 doses a week. That's the actual number because it's the number of doses in a Pfizer pack. So they would like to do some locations on the Outer Cape as well, but it seems like they're going to have to be splitting up those doses among the different locations each week. And they have not, as of last night, the last time I checked, they had not announced where the clinics were going to be next week.
Now, there's still confusion about where people could sign up to get a shot if they're in that 75 and older cohort. Can you explain for us once more how people should be looking for an appointment?
Sure. Okay, so I'll talk web and I'll talk phone. So the state has two websites that you can use to get you there to the right place. One way is to just go to the state homepage, mass.gov, and then you click on COVID-19 vaccine. That will get you to a map of the site. You can also go to a separate web portal, which is sponsored by the state as well, at maimmunizations.org. Both of those pages have the mass vaccination sites, such as Foxboro. They have pharmacies. They have hospitals. And the map now finally shows the Barnstable County sites as well, after not initially showing them. But I noticed when you look at the map and you go to click on that for the Barnstable County sites, then it just directs you back over to maimmunizations.org. So that's really where you need to be, at least for the county sites. And then on the phone side, Governor Baker has promised that he would have an appointment call center starting this week, but I have not seen any announced phone number for that yet. Barnstable County also said it might start using its COVID helpline for appointments. To my knowledge, that's not happening yet either.
So, folks who don't have internet access, stand by for that statewide number to be announced. They are expecting it again. Sometime by the end of this week is what they had promised, but we haven't seen that yet as of Friday morning. As of also on Wednesday, the county attempted something of kind of like a magic trick, inviting all of the Cape older population to jump on a single phone call. Eve Zuckoff, you sat in on the call that the county put out. What was the message they were trying to get out to these folks?
Yeah, so the goal that they had was kind of twofold. First, they wanted to provide information on the vaccine, its effectiveness. And then second, they wanted to provide information, like what Jeanette is talking about, on what you can expect about the availability of vaccination appointments going forward. And in talking about the vaccine rollout, they said one of the main updates is that the governor has committed to unveiling a phone booking option. But they talked plainly about it as a clear miss so far, that the phone option is coming so late. And this is where the officials on the call, the tone was really one of kind of commiseration. They acknowledge this online system hasn't been easy to navigate, even for computer-savvy people, and they asked for patience. But again, they seem to really understand that many seniors and families are at the end of their rope. It's been a very long and hard pandemic for a lot of people, and people weren't expecting it to be so hard to sign up to get a vaccine.
I understand at the end of this call, folks on the line were able to ask questions. What kind of feedback did officials get?
Yeah, so the questions, the interesting feature of the call is that it actually allowed the county to collect the phone numbers from over 600 people who said they don't have access to internet by pushing a button, and 100 people who said they would need a ride to their vaccine appointment. So officials also allowed for some questions, and people asked, you know, I take blood thinners and I have cancer. Can I take the COVID-19 vaccine? Will there be accommodations at vaccination sites for people with disabilities or who can't stand or sit for long times? Will primary care doctors have supply of vaccines in their office? And the list really goes on. And I think what those questions showed is that people are still really struggling to get critical and basic information that they need to understand this vaccine, where to get it, and if they should. And the county has a big mountain to climb to overcome what those questions reflect.
Jeanette, we have seen some good news around COVID case numbers this week. Where are we at?
Well, the numbers are trending downward now, at least in terms of cases. Vera Harik from Barnstable County, she tracks the data. She says it's very clear to her that we are on the other side of the holiday surge. So heads down.
Jeanette's line seems to be dropping in and out there. Let's step over to Sam Houghton just for a moment this week. Sam, let me ask you about the push for a mass vaccination site to be located on the Cape. This is kind of what the state is doing at Gillette Stadium and at Fenway Park, a central distribution point. The county commissioners weighed in on this. What did they say?
Yeah, this is the county commissioners. They're an elected board of, you know, three members that kind of oversee or advise Barnstable County government. And I think you get a lot of complaints about the rollout process from seniors, you know, is transportation. Gillette Stadium, Fenway Park, those are, you know, can be 100 miles away if you live in Provincetown. And that's where the state is, you know, providing a lot of these appointments. And the county commissioners are saying, you know, Cape Cod has one of the most elderly populations in the state, if not all of New England. So they're saying, well, we should set one of these sites up here on the Cape. It won't be that long for seniors to travel. And you know, because we have this elderly population, that'll help the region out a lot.
Jeanette Barnes, I think you're back on the line. Julian Sear, the state senator who's kind of been the spokesman for the task force here, he has been the spokesman, was talking about this too this week, about the need for a mass vaccination site.
Yes, he was. So I couldn't quite hear Sam, truthfully, but yeah, so I think Sam mentioned the county commissioners have passed a resolution asking
right.
for a mass vaccination site, right? And the legislators are asking for it as well. Senator Sear did say yesterday, though, that until the Cape does get one, it can really kind of look to the islands as an example of how smaller communities can do this vaccination efficiently. The islands, of course, are expecting next week to be finished with their 75 and up population. But the whole thing, again, for the Cape is dependent on getting more doses for their larger populations than the islands. Pharmacies are getting some doses, the county is getting some doses, but so far it really hasn't been enough.
Sam Houghton, let me ask you about what Jeanette's mentioning there. Nantucket officials who say that they could be done vaccinating all of the island's residents who are 75 and older by the end of next week. And this, while so many other places are still struggling to really get this process started, explain for us why this is working out so well on the island.
Yeah, I think it's a little complicated, but first off, the hospital on the island is running the rollout, and they're part of the Mass General Hospital system. So they receive vaccine doses from the state as well as Mass General, and they are expecting to vaccinate about 600, 650, maybe even 700 of the 75-plus age group by the end of next week, right? So I think there's a number of reasons why they're getting, you know, more doses per capita for 75-plus. I think, you know, there aren't as many seniors on the island compared to, say, Barnstable County. I looked at census data, and there's about 1,500 residents 65 or older compared to 65,000 on the Cape, so quite a big difference there. Meanwhile, vaccines are rolling, as Jeanette said, onto the Cape through the county, through the hospital, through towns, through community health centers and pharmacies. And on Nantucket, it's just the hospital. And that process is a little less transparent on the Cape, especially the rollout to pharmacies. We actually don't know how many vaccine are going to the pharmacies on the Cape. I did, you know, put that question to Nantucket officials why they are getting a lot of doses. They say it's because they've been, you know, really efficient. They've been able to use exactly how much the state sends them in phase one of the rollout. And I think it's also important to say, you know, the hospital, they take care of 99% of the island senior population. You know, pre-COVID, during COVID, they know how to get in touch with their seniors, and then they know which patients are most vulnerable. So they're really poised to deliver this vaccine efficiently.
The rest of the region is not as compacted in its care delivery systems. I'm thinking about the South Coast, which has a much bigger hill to climb with this. You spoke to the mayor of Fall River this week. What did you hear from him?
Yeah, I think like most of the state, it's not as smooth. Paul Coogan is the mayor, and I get the sense, you know, he's frustrated. He has a city of nearly 90,000 people. And he told me they got something like 400 doses, and that's impossible to vaccinate a city when you only have that many doses. But they have started a clinic for seniors this week at Bristol Community College. They have more planned for next week. You know, I think important here, Fall River was hit pretty hard by the pandemic. January was one of the worst months for the city. Something like 60 residents died over the month. But that it is starting to go in the right direction. The cases are going down. And meanwhile, on the South Coast, the South Coast Health, the major hospital there, they've announced several clinics to be held next week as well. They're planning to administer 2,700 doses, I believe. And there are also some pharmacies in Fall River. But I think, you know, the mayor's point is taken. It's been frustrating, and I think a lot that's in tune with a lot of people across the state.
Now, we've talked about the counties and the towns and the hospitals, but another player in the vaccination rollout will be the community health centers, and they're pushing ahead to offer vaccinations. You spoke to community health centers on the South Coast and also in the Upper Cape. What did you hear?
Yeah, the Greater New Bedford Community Health Center and the Community Health Center on Cape Cod each have between, you know, 1,000 and 1,500 patients in the 75-plus age group, and each are getting their own shipments outside these county delivery doses. And they've begun vaccinations in New Bedford, but I think we're going to start to see that really ramp up in the coming weeks. And similar to Nantucket here, they're reaching out directly to their patients to set up vaccine appointments. So their patients won't have to wade through, you know, the state website that's been the source of a lot of confusion.
Jeanette Barnes, before we go to the break, I want to ask you about a non-COVID story that you covered this week. Barnstable School District moved forward from what's been a lengthy period of self-examination. The district will now be looking for a new mascot. This comes about after a school committee meeting on Wednesday night, and this was not a decision taken without first plenty of discussion. Tell us about this. Do we have you there, Jeanette?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Yep. Okay. So, yes, the Barnstable School Committee first voted in August to replace the mascot because of complaints, of course, that mascots representing Native American people are racist. More recently, one of the members of the committee...
Jeanette's line seems to be drifting in and out here.
I'm here.
Okay, come on. Go ahead.
Sorry. Joe Nystrom asked them to consider keeping the name Red Raider and attaching image. Wednesday, he brought to the school committee the idea that the word Raider might actually have been intended to honor a man who was a Marine Raider from this area and who died in World War II. He said he didn't really have proof of that, but he wanted to discuss it. Other members said, you know, they really felt that no matter what the origin was, that the language has taken on a meaning that really it can't be separated from the Native American imagery. And by the end, Joe Nystrom really said he was reconsidering. That came right after another member, Kathy Bent, compared the Red Raider to the way that other words in our language that are no longer acceptable of people. So that was a really interesting kind of quick turn in the meeting.
So Jeanette, you are kind of drifting in and out here a little bit on the line. The final outcome is that the Barnstable School District is now going to be looking forward to selecting a new mascot, and they say that they've kind of identified three possibilities, and they're going to put a survey out to some of the school community. Is that right?
Yes. They collected ideas.
Okay, we're going to just, I know that they're going to survey the intermediate school students and also high school students and move forward that way. We'll all have to stay tuned to find out what those three options for the new mascot could be. Jeanette Barnes from CAI, Eve Zuckoff, our environmental reporter and sometimes our COVID reporter, and Sam Houghton, Morning Edition producer and reporter from CAI. Thank you all for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A winter storm earlier this week provided another reminder, if one was needed, that our region is really at the mercy of the ocean and that the land around us is being reshaped continually. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us now with a look at how this is playing out on the island. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, start by telling us how the island was impacted by this latest storm this past weekend.
Well, everyone's familiar with the storm that came through on Sunday and Monday. And by Monday afternoon, a high tide and storm surge had pretty much brought about 300 feet of flooding over and people who have been to the island are familiar with South Beach, too. It's one of the most popular public beaches on the island. The entire Right Fork parking lot was covered in water. It looked essentially like there was a new coastal pond that had emerged. The bathroom area was completely flooded. Video shows what it pretty much looks like a river was coming down the road. They had to close at least three intersections down in Katama. And the entire dune that existed, sort of functioned basically as a protector for the beach, was flattened as well. So it was really impactful. And frankly, it was kind of surprising. I mean, true, it was a totally ferocious storm that came through this weekend, but I don't think anyone was expecting it to be, or with the flooding to be as dramatic as it was.
You point out in this article that obviously, you know, being in a coastal situation or an island completely surrounded by water, the land is being reshaped by the ocean, but that it seems to be a condition that's getting worse in past few years.
Right, and there's a few factors behind that. At least the South Beach situation, we talked to Tara Martin, who works with the Woods Hole Group and has been studying the beach for about two decades. And she said that actually back in 2018, there were three back-to-back-to-back storms that pretty much flattened the dune and ate away at it. And when that happened, a lot of the beach disappeared. And I guess beaches, they are actually the first line of defense for the island against any sort of storm. When the beach goes, then it leaves the dune vulnerable. And when the beach becomes steep, at least the way it is now, it sort of eats away at the dune's core. And so really it's sort of the ferocity of the winter storms. They're getting worse and worse, and they're happening sort of in a row. And that is being, you know, that is sort of compounding the problem for the island. And also the sort of forces that the island's experiencing are some of the strongest on the East Coast. I guess there was sort of this wave modeling that was done down at South Beach, and they found that they actually are some of the strongest waves that have that are happening all around the Atlantic seaboard, which was pretty interesting to hear. And anyone who's been down there during the summer can attest to it. It's sort of advancing, the increasing ferocity of winter storms.
I was going to ask you, what are island planners saying about how to respond to all that?
Well, there has been sort of a flurry of coastal zone management grant funding that's come through. One interesting project that's happening with Oak Bluffs and the Martha's Vineyard Commission is that they got a lot of money to map storm tide pathways in the islands. One of the other problems is that on the north side, there are a lot of low-lying roads, State Road, Beach Road in Tisbury that connects Tisbury to Oak Bluffs. Those are basically just above sea level. And so that project is going to look at basically when there is a high tide or storm, where does the flooding occur? And how can we prepare in those specific areas for flooding when it happens? But then down at South Beach, actually, Edgartown has received a bunch of money from the state to try and restore and replenish the dune in front of Left Fork. And that's really important because that's the entrance to Norton Point Beach. There is a beach house there. There's lifeguard facilities. And right now, that entire sort of building area is where the dune should be. And so the whole plan is to try and replenish and restore the dune. But it's a huge sort of against the current upstream battle because you need hundreds and thousands of yards of sand to be able to do it. And once the sand is sort of used to replenish the dune, you know, it's a lot of it is sacrificial. It's sort of this cyclical process of having to replenish and fight back against it. It really is something that island planners are trying to wrap their head around right now, and I don't think they have all the answers yet.
It is Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Arts performance spaces have suffered in the pandemic, but many are now looking ahead to a better summer, they hope, than last year. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with a story about the Harwich Junior Theater reinventing itself. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, tell us about the plan that the theater is proposing for this summer.
Sure. Like you said, it's been a tough year for local theaters. A lot of them have tried to innovate with online productions and other methods to try to stay relevant. The Cape Cod Theater Company, the Harwich Junior Theater in Harwich, for them, the revenue this year, they said, was down $475,000, which is really the majority of their annual budget. So they are looking at ways to somehow work with COVID restrictions and to stay relevant and reinvent themselves, like you said. And their solution is a new outdoor stage, which they're planning to build right next door to the theater building on Division Street. Right now, there's a parking area and an old summer cottage on that land. What they're planning to do is tear down the cottage and build a 24 by 32 foot stage with social distancing seating for about 40 to 50 people. Much of the funding for the project is going to come from the Belzikian Family Foundation. And, you know, they're in the early process of this. They just announced it last week. They've got a few hoops to still jump through. But town officials and neighbors, more especially, are supportive of the project. And it seems like a really appropriate way for the theater to mark its 70th anniversary, which is coming up this year.
We have just about a minute, but I want to ask you about another story you've got in the paper. The community has been rallying around a Chatham artist in his time of need. Tell us about this.
Sure. Chatham artist Steve Lyons, about a year ago, last March, he noticed small flashes of light in his peripheral vision. He was diagnosed with glioblastoma, which is a particularly aggressive form of brain cancer. And after undergoing some treatment at Dana-Farber, he signed on to a new treatment at the University of California. And he had surgery, and treatment was progressing. When both Lyons and his partner of 36 years, Peter Demers, they both came down with COVID out there in Los Angeles. And Lyons has recovered, but unfortunately his partner did not. So not only is he coping with the recovery, but he's also coping with the loss of his life partner. And friends and colleagues here in Chatham and elsewhere are raising money to try to get Steve back home to Chatham. It's an expensive medical flight that he's going to need because of all the care he requires. They started a GoFundMe page. They exceeded their $25,000 goal in less than a week. Last time I checked yesterday, the total was up to around $32,000. If you're interested in finding out about this or donating, you can go to GoFundMe.com and search for Steve's Homecoming.
That is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
The town of Eastham has been considering a residential tax exemption. Neighboring towns on the Outer Cape have adopted this, but Eastham will give it a pass, at least for a little bit longer. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent has this story and joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
Ed, maybe you better start by explaining what a residential tax exemption is for those of people who may not know, and then we can talk about some of the quirks here, which are interesting.
Yes, exactly. The residential tax exemption is an optional policy that towns can adopt. It was originally enacted in the state in 1979, and it allows towns to... It's a way of allocating the tax, the property tax burden among homeowners in order to lessen the burden somewhat on so-called domiciled residents. That is, people who live in the town year-round or whose primary residence is in town. And the reason for it is to... help people who live in places where the price of real estate has gotten, you know, sort of amazingly high because largely of people from out-of-town places driving up the cost of living here, which is certainly true in a number of places on Cape Cod and the islands. Six towns on the Cape and the islands have the residential tax exemption. Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, Barnstable, Nantucket, and Tisbury. And the way it works is the homeowner is allowed to reduce the taxable portion of their tax assessment by a certain amount that is set by the Board of Selectmen. The select boards every year have to make a decision of whether to adopt the residential tax exemption, and if so, what the percentage of the average or median price of a home will be exempted. And so every year this happens, and in Eastham, the select board has been looking at it for several years now, and a year or so ago, when they looked at it, they said, "Well, we're not going to do this, at least not yet, because really the effect of it increases as the percentage of second homes in the community increases. So, for example, in Truro, about 80% of the homes in the town are our second or third or fourth homes. And in Eastham, they decided a year or more ago that if it ever reached 60%, then it would be reasonable to adopt this exemption. And but they said we're not there. And this year, a couple of weeks ago, when the select board met to talk about it again, they got a report from their finance director saying that the percentage of homes in Eastham that were second homes or seasonal homes was only 45%. And they also had gotten a lot of email messages, we think 60 or more, from people that apparently were very negative. This is a somewhat controversial policy. So they decided against it.
But it turns out the number of homes might be much higher. The second homes and second or third or seasonal homes, as you call them, in Truro, or in Eastham, rather, I'm sorry, might be much higher than the 45% that the town was looking at.
Well, yeah, there's a question about this, simply because we also have in this week's issue of the Provincetown Independent a story by Paul Benson about data that's been collected and published by the Cape Cod Commission, which does a tremendous amount of work on collecting statistics about all kinds of important things about the Cape. And they have a website with statistics on home ownership. And according to the Cape Cod Commission's numbers, the percentage of homes in Eastham that are seasonal is 60.6%, not 45%, as the town's finance director, Rich Bienvenu, reported. And it's really not clear to us why there is such a large discrepancy. We know that the 2010 census, which also collects this information, reported that the percentage of homes that were seasonal in Eastham then was 55%. So doesn't really make a lot of sense to us that the percentage would have gone down in the last 10 years or so from 55 to 45. But why those numbers differ so much, we're still kind of trying to figure that out here.
It is Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent.
Great.
Ed, we have to leave it there, but definitely people should check out the article because there's also more about how the town is looking, what other options the town is taking into account as it looks at trying to address its funding issues. Ed Miller, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. East Chop Lighthouse is the site of lead contamination in the soil. If that sounds oddly familiar to you, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times can connect the dots to another lighthouse or two. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, your reporter Rich Salzberg really dug into this. Tell us about the contamination at East Chop and how really it's an echo to contamination found at other sites on the island.
Yeah, Rich has really been doing a lot of work on this, a lot of it through public records requests, and that can be tedious work, but he's doing great work in finding out that the Coast Guard knew about this contamination long before they originally admitted. This goes back to 2003. They knew the levels of contamination around the East Chop Lighthouse, significant because, and this is contamination in the ground surrounding the lighthouse, significant because the museum over on the island has been doing tours for years there, and also there's a public park that Oak Bluffs controls that is there. Right now, both are closed, while they're researching how much of this is going to be cleaned up by the federal government, and there is work happening there supposed to be happening today to do a little bit more investigation of exactly what's there and what needs to be cleaned up. But officials from Oak Bluff and the museum are saying they're not going to be sending anybody back there until they're satisfied that the site has been cleaned up and won't harm anybody. Because lead, as we all know, particularly in young people, can be really damaging to their neurological system.
This isn't the first lighthouse, though, with lead issues.
No, that's correct. Rich also uncovered a couple of years ago that over in West Chop, there was a lighthouse, contamination there. Significant there is that they had Coast Guard housing there, and folks from the Menumpsha station were living there with children. And the Coast Guard also knew about contamination in those living quarters and yet allowed people to live there. So that also is pretty disturbing.
I want to ask you about another story you have in the paper this week. A significant figure is departing the Sheriff's Meadow Foundation. For anyone not familiar with us, tell us about the foundation and then what Bill Bridwell has meant to it.
Yeah, Sheriff's Meadow Foundation owns a lot of property on the island, and it's a nonprofit. They're preserving the land, and this is Bill Bridwell has been, quote-unquote, the ambassador. And if that name sounds familiar to folks, it's because his uncle Norman is the author and cartoonist best known for Clifford the Big Red Dog. He came to the island about 30 years ago. He always wanted to live on the island, and he was able to land this job. At the time, Sheriff's Meadow was much smaller, and it was much easier to be the property manager, but through the years, it's become a full-time job for him, and he's really, really well-respected and liked. I would encourage folks to click in on the video that accompanies this. We didn't produce the video, some of the folks at Sheriff's Meadow did, but just hearing people speak about what a contribution Bill made to Sheriff's Meadow and the island is just, it's nice. You know, you hope to make a difference in your life, and certainly Bill has done that in helping Sheriff's Meadow grow and become a significant preservationist organization on the island.
It is a great story. You can find that in the Martha's Vineyard Times. George Brennan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good day.
You too. Time now for a look at news from the State House. Every couple of years, controversy bubbles up on Beacon Hill regarding transparency in the legislature, especially when it comes to how committees decide on bills and if votes on the floor should be recorded. CAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about how activists are pushing harder this year to make Beacon Hill a more open place for the constituents lawmakers serve. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine. Good to be with you.
Glad to have you. So there's a group of activists, and interestingly, some are within the House itself, but there are many more supposedly outside the legislature who are fighting for changes to the rules that the House uses to conduct business. House Speaker Ron Mariano has delayed the debate over these rules, saying that he wants to give members more time to consider them. Talk more about this group of activists and what they want.
Yeah, the group's called Act on Mass, and they claim to have recruited thousands of volunteers from most districts from around the state, and they're using this kind of volunteer base to put pressure on individual members to support their pledge that they have to change the rules and increase transparency at the State House. So they have three main demands. The first one is to make all committee votes publicly available upon request. So these are technically already available, but they're buried very deep inside certain official documents from the clerk's office, and it's hard to get at what exactly is going on in these committees, how they vote yes, how they don't vote, how they vote no, that kind of thing. There's also concern that there's so much email usage in these poll the committee votes, that those aren't being tracked as accurately as they probably could be. So they want to get more of that on the record and publicly available. One other thing they're looking for is to get all testimony that's submitted to these committees, have that online as publicly as everything else. Now, in the COVID era, a lot of the committees are being done only electronically. There aren't the big in-person hearings that you used to have. So all of the information, material that members are using to make their decisions on how to vote is essentially letters from advocates and different advocacy groups that's being emailed in. They want to get at that. The last thing they want to do is lower the number of members that a representative needs in order to insist on a floor vote to be taken for a roll call. A lot of the time, it's just an up or down vote called a voice vote. You know, yay or nay, the yays have it, they move on. It's rare that they actually stop to take a full roll call vote where everyone individually is on the record. So this would lower the threshold. So if somebody wants to insist on one of those roll call votes, instead of having, 14 members, they would only have to have 7 members on their side to go and do that kind of thing. So, those are their demands. But, beyond that, we don't really know much about this Act on Mass group. They're the new kid on the block. They're pretty small as far as staff, but they say they have this army of volunteers, and they say that their funding does come from independent donors, and they admit some labor unions. But there's an ironic twist here that they won't tell me where their funding comes from. So there's a lot of questions on Beacon Hill as to who's behind this group, why they're doing what they are, and fighting against transparency in this way, which is, the Beacon Hill tradition.
It certainly is the Beacon Hill tradition. We've talked about this before. It, this so-called lack of sunshine. We use that term in journalism sometimes when things are not transparent. So I guess it's not surprising there isn't much support for making any real changes on Beacon Hill, is there?
Yeah, just the status quo is that there's very little made public in Massachusetts. The legislature, the executive branch, which is the governor's office, and the courts all essentially excuse themselves from the public records laws that we do have. So a lot of this is done in the name of expediency, especially in the legislature, where roll call votes take an awfully long time, especially in the COVID era where everything's remote and they have to wrangle 160 votes and members to see who's a yes, who's a no. But, when it comes down to it, they expose lawmakers' votes to the public. And that's never been popular with incumbents and with the rank and file, who would much rather just kind of go with the flow and not have that record of votes to be scrutinized by their voters, by constituents. Add to that the fact that the legislature has an approval rating of 65%. That's one of the highest in the country when it comes to how people feel about their state legislature. Act on Mass has only managed to recruit 20 of the House's 160 members to take this pledge. So I would say that there is some appetite to make some reforms, step in the direction of transparency with a new speaker, with some new members. That seems like the appropriate way that they feel like it's going to go. However, this more radical approach that groups like Act on Mass are asking for, it doesn't seem like too many members are on their side.
We're already a few weeks into this session. House Speaker Ron Mariano and his peers have to eventually settle on some new rules, right?
Right. So right now, Mariano said the House is going to use the current temporary rules that they put in place when they established remote voting during the pandemic. So these were put in place last year. So it's kind of a two-angled thing coming from Mariano. First, he wants to evaluate how this remote voting is going, how can we fix that, because those were put in place on a temporary basis, if they're going to be, a longer-term thing or what. So I would say the main brunt of this delay is because of COVID. And the other is to take into account some of the requests for changes to the rules and some of these transparency steps they might want to take. Again, there's a whole bunch of new members that are coming in. And like I said, members are being influenced in their districts by these volunteers who are, being confronted with groups like Act on Mass and saying, we want you to do this. So it's something of a groundswell, but Beacon Hill might be resistant to do it.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Boston. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Oh, you too.
And that is CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're turning again to CAI's Eve Zukoff to talk about the latest update on the Massachusetts Army National Guard's proposal to build a machine gun range on Cape Cod. Eve, welcome back. We had you at the beginning of the show. Now we've got you again.
Happy to be here again.
So this update story really starts last month when the Association to Preserve Cape Cod requested the release of 900 individual comments that the Guard received over a proposal to build this machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod. This is under the state public records law. What's happening now with this request?
Yeah, so exactly. So I'm going to explain how APCC actually got the Guard to release a trove of documents. So last week, the Guard told APCC that their request to see those 900 comments needed to be filed under the Federal Freedom of Information Act, not under the state's public records law, because the range would be paid for with federal funds. And APCC interpreted that as a way of being pushed into kind of a bureaucratic loop. They actually called it petty, especially considering the range will be built on state-owned land. So they decided this week to appeal to the Massachusetts Secretary of State to override the Guard, which would force the release of the 900 comments. And after APCC made their intention public, CAI reached out to Guard officials, trying to understand what was happening from their point of view. And then there seemed to be a shift. So Guard officials called APCC and WCAI yesterday to say all 900 comments would be released within 24 hours. I heard late last night APCC has them now and will be releasing them to the public early next week.
So what's the importance of these 900 comments? What's at stake here?
Yeah, so the idea here is that the State Environmental Management Commission must approve the machine gun range project before the Guard can move forward with construction. And environmentalists believe that those 900 comments reflect an enormous outpouring of public opposition, and that the state needs to know that. It should be public information that there's enormous outcry about this range, and that public sentiment should be weighed heavily against any decision to approve the project. Now, I will say we talked very briefly with a Guard official yesterday who said the goal is to keep the public informed and respond to requests for information. And now that the 900 comments are about to be public, we will be trying to figure out what they mean and what they actually do reflect when it comes to public sentiment.
Remind us about what the issue is here, what the concerns are environmentally around this proposed machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod. It's already a military base. What has people so concerned?
Yeah, so it's a proposed 8-lane range, and it would require the clear cutting of 170 acres of forest land as part of a 5,000-acre danger zone. It's just under a quarter of the land on the base, and there are a lot of environmental questions about what happens when you lose that amount of land to, you know, the wildlife in that area. And also, if you have a machine gun range, what kind of, carbon footprint are you going to have? And this base is built on top of a massive, the Cape's sole source aquifer. Most Upper Cape towns get their water, their fresh water from the water underneath the base. Do we start creeping back into the history of groundwater contamination that the base has had by allowing for this new military installment? That is the question that environmentalists have. And base officials have said, we are members of this community. We would not do anything to harm, the local environment, especially not groundwater. It's the water we drink, too. There's a real history of mistrust and contamination. And there are questions about transparency. There have been a lot of people who haven't known that this was happening and that this project has been underway for almost a decade. And so there are questions about, if it's so well thought out, why didn't we know about it sooner?
CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Spoke with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We heard from CAI's Mike Dean at the State House. Big thanks to our Dan Tridle back at the studio. When the gremlins start playing with the phone lines, he's an expert hand at clearing them out. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.